This is Sylvester McCoy. You're listening to Who Made Who, and Me Made Me, and my mother and father did the same.
You're listening to a podcast from the Cinema Geekly Podcast Network. We're the geeks you deserve and the ones you need right now.
Welcome to Who Made Who, Cinema Geekly's Doctor Who podcast. It is Anthony Lewis and Ben Knight, and we are back to talk more Doctor Who. Series 14, Episode 0, the Christmas special. The Church on Ruby Road. And this is the very first episode of Dr. Chudy, as he is... This is the first full episode with him, anyway. He obviously appeared in the final David Tennant episode as well, but this is the first full-on his story and like what the show's vibe is going to be like. So this is our first look at that. And here,
that's already an interesting point. We'll come back to that. The idea that this is what we think the show's vibe is going to be in under Chudy as the Doctor.
Mm-hmm. 19 years ago, from the present, a hooded woman abandons a baby outside of a church. In the present day, the Foundling, Ruby Sunday, which, by the way, that is what they call Din Djarin in The Mandalorian. Just saying.
Yes.
Foundling. Is trying to find her birth parents using a DNA test, but to no avail. After an interview with Davina McCall, Ruby finds herself repeatedly experiencing unnatural bad luck and has several encounters with the 15th Doctor. After her adoptive mother, Carla, fosters another baby, Ruby witnesses goblins kidnap the baby and boards their flying ship in an attempt to save her, encountering the Doctor once again. Held captive by the goblins, the Doctor reveals the goblins have manipulated time to cause Ruby's bad luck and to feed on coincidence, a thing that I guess really helps out the goblins. Namely, Ruby and the baby sharing a birthday on Christmas Eve, which is, you know, pretty coincidental. The Doctor and the Rubies, and the Ruby, that could be her new nickname.
Doctor and the Rubies, everyone's favorite new band.
That is my favorite 50s band, Ben. They save the baby from being eaten by the goblins and return her home to Carla. However, coincidences binding the Doctor and Ruby together lead the goblins traveling back in time and wanting to eat Ruby as a baby. And I guess they succeed because the next thing the Doctor knows, Ruby doesn't exist and nobody remembers her except for him. So the Doctor uses the TARDIS to travel back.
Just like
back.
Me in people's phone books on New Year's Eve.
Right.
The same people.
Doctor uses the TARDIS to travel back 19 years and to save Ruby as a baby, destroying the goblins and their ship in the process. Returning to the present day, the Doctor is reunited with Ruby and goes to leave in the TARDIS. However, Ruby deduces the Doctor is a time traveler and decides to accompany him. Ben, your thoughts on the Christmas special?
After the last episode, listener, you'd be pleased to say, pleased to know I'm just going to go, yeah, it was all right.
Yeah, not really. It's fine.
It's fine. Fans of podcasts.
The Glenn review.
Actually, he does do that a lot, doesn't he, actually?
He does do that a lot.
I wait, he usually has quite a long sort of pregnant pause and then goes, yeah, it's fine. Yeah. Anyway.
Glenn, what did you think about the movie? It was okay. That's a very Glenn review.
Yeah, it is. I like his reviews. So first of all, woo, Christmas special for the first time in ages. Yay. Action on Christmas Day. Yay. Did I watch it on Christmas Day for the sake of keeping up this pretense? Yay. No, I didn't, obviously.
No, me either.
I'll tell you why, because adult Whovians don't watch Doctor Who on Christmas Day.
They're in
the presence of any children or indeed any other relative who does not watch Doctor Who, because people are goddamn annoying.
Mm-hmm.
Is that harsh or is that entirely, I don't know.
It's a little harsh, maybe. A little harsh.
But, harsh but fair. So Doctor Who Does Labyrinth story was fun. Missing obviously David Bowie, but never mind. They replaced David with a cameo performance by the aged quite badly, I would say, Jabba the Hutt. In the
he's looking rough,
isn't he? Mind you, I didn't see Hoggle, so that's good. Hoggle. Anyway, too many Labyrinth references.
Yes. I've never seen Labyrinth, Ben. So.
Oh, wow. Okay. You give me two revelations in the course of the last two episodes. One is you've never seen Labyrinth, and oh, no, it was during Podjockey. She told me that you'd never seen the film The Fly.
No. Nope.
Were you put off by the terrible U2 record? Anyway, I don't know. Right. Stay on topic. Right. So, Millie Gibson. Hurrah, Millie Gibson as Ruby Sunday. I was surprised how much I liked her character because I have only ever seen her. I think most people have only ever seen her as Kelly, I think her name is, in Coronation Street.
Okay.
I'm going to be really mean now. And actually, if any of my local Whovian friends, as in local to Greater Manchester, hear this, they might be a bit cross with me, especially those who are actually in Coronation Street, who I know we've got a couple of listeners who are. The thing about it is Coronation Street does have a tendency of casting Millie Gibson types every few years. They hang around a bit and then they disappear and you immediately forget them because they're replaced with another Millie Gibson type.
Yeah.
And that's a problem mainly with the way that that show is made and the fact that, you know, they come out of drama school and then immediately go off to do far more impressive and interesting things, or, you know, don't, one or the other.
Well, I won't tell Llewellyn you said that, so.
No, please don't, crikey. Oh, no. No, there's too few people on that station that we shouldn't talk to about that. But Ruby Sunday, I kind of initially, my first thought was, oh dear, we're getting, you know, the Coronation Street interchangeable character as now a feature of Doctor Who, which is unfortunate. I did think, well, this is Russell merging his two favourite places. In fact, the two places he has homes, certainly that I'm aware of. One up here in Greater Manchester and obviously down in South Wales. That's why we've got the classic Mancunian and the references to people not moving to London. Because, well, why would you if you live in Manchester? Mm-hmm. Fair point.
But of course.
Absolutely. So all of that. It was an incredibly British episode, actually, in many ways. So you've got a lot of in-jokes that are very British in-jokes, linguistically to do with places and so on as well. Mm-hmm. You've got the casting, which, you know, as I say, leans heavily not only on Coronation Street actor, but also an EastEnders actor in the form of Anita Dobson, playing Mrs. Flood in this, if you're not familiar, but far more famously for playing Ange in EastEnders. Best EastEnders character ever. and you've got Davina McCall, of course, who I don't know how I'm going to say, I'm guessing she's not particularly well known anywhere outside of the UK.
No,
because
not heard of her.
Davina is she's a television presenter and has been for God many years now. She probably, I'm just about old enough to remember her doing a show called Street Mate, which was quite successful amongst youth TV sorts. And then she went on and became sort of culturally ingrained, even amongst those who didn't watch such trashy television, as being the presenter of Big Brother. And heavily parodied because she used to be very overexcitable. Everything's so exciting.
She's very understated, you know, in this episode.
Well, this is it. So now because I don't watch ITV very often, and she's very much an ITV personality.
Yeah.
She I haven't really seen her. I mean, she occasionally pops up on the radio. Because she's friends with Moyles, who I listen to, and so she does occasionally appear on there.
Yeah.
But I hadn't really been aware of her doing anything on TV for ages. And it turns out she's been doing this TV show. The show that they're that they have in this episode of Doctor Who is a real TV show. Interestingly, it's an ITV show. So this is the commercial competitor of the BBC and, I suppose, of Disney, really.
Worlds colliding.
Yeah, and I was so surprised to not just see her in it, because I guess, you know, I mean, she has done bits for the BBC over the years, but to see her in it being, and they haven't even changed the name, she's doing the TV show that she does do in real life on ITV.
Yeah.
I understand, in fact, the BBC, well, the production team from this actually contacted the production team of her show on ITV and said, right, we want to make sure that, you know, we film that the way that you would set it up. We want this to look and feel like production of your show, so that Davina looks and feels like she's making an episode of your show. So there was a really nice sort of, that awful word, there was a nice synergy between two usually very competitive outfits there, which I thought was cute. But as a result, I mean, Davina occasionally pops up doing little bits of cameo acting and stuff. And I thought she was really rather adorable in this. Mm-hmm. She came across as being exactly how you would expect Davina to be interviewing this potential candidate, Ruby Sunday, for her TV show. I'm almost tempted to go back and have a quick look at the TV show that Davina actually does. I probably won't, I won't lie. But
it did make you curious.
It did make me curious.
Maybe you'll look up a YouTube clip.
Well, I'm thinking it might be ITV's gambit, actually, is to... I mean, first of all, they've now got an ITV TV show firmly embedded within a BBC properties canon, which could work ITV. But also, there will have been other people who went, that's what Davina's doing now. Oh, yeah. Have a look at that. So, fair play to them.
Yeah, it could be smart.
The sort of plot aspects of this, I'm not going to lie, I didn't like the notion of it. The time travel sort of loop story that I enjoyed. I thought the issue part of the episode, which is the care kid, caring and fostering system thing, and that difference in the role between Ruby's mum and her grandmother, actually. So that's Michelle Greenidge and Angela Winter, I think. The difference in their attitudes in the world in which Ruby exists and the mm-hmm. world in which she doesn't. I mean, points for Carla Sunday actress Michelle Greenidge, who, again, I mean, I only become aware of her because she's in a fantastic little comedy show called Mandy on the BBC, which if you haven't seen it, I strongly recommend. That's on the subject, actually, of, amongst other things, on, you know, that's references the care system, foster system and stuff as well. Yeah. And it's a superb bit of television, but it's so fucking funny. But yeah, so some great performances in there. Brilliant. The way they deal with the care thing, being a ex-care kid myself, I was slightly on tenterhooks as to how they dealt with it. I thought really well and realistically, kind of made me think, I kind of wish my foster parents had been more like the Carla Sunday in the world in which Ruby did exist, rather than the Carla Sunday dealing with the inconvenient foster kid at Christmas, which I have to say was rather closer to my experience. Mm-hmm. Literally shipped out at Christmas. Go and be somewhere else. But you know, it is what it is. But that's kind of where my enjoyment of the sort of character driven plot of this episode started and finished. The musical number, in fact, basically everything that occurs on the Goblin ship, I'm not going to lie, I didn't enjoy it.
It was the least entertaining part for me, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, so the aesthetics of the ship were great. I loved the way they did it. The mechanics of taking these, I think, 6-7 actors who played the goblins are super. By the way, even, you know, in the behind-the-scenes show, the quality of the prosthetic and costume and choreo. Oh, fucking stunning. I mean, just the quality of that work is superb. And yet again, just shows the people who work with Bad Wolf to make Who are just extraordinary puppeteers. Also, the senior puppeteer on this show, just going to say, just anyone who's interested, quite the hottie. I strongly recommend checking out the behind-the-scenes show of Doctor Who and just keeping an eye out for somebody who I think is destined to become everyone's favourite puppeteer. But anyway, I nearly made a disgusting joke and I shan't because it's a family show.
Yeah,
anyway,
we don't. I think no. I already know where it's going, and I don't even want to repeat
pretty
it.
Much, exactly. You all know what the joke was going to be. The musical number itself, isn't it weird that got released as a record and actually did reasonably well in the Christmas charts?
I had no idea.
Yeah, it was a weird decision.
It's anyway. A goofy song.
It is a goofy song, and the bit where they decide that they're going to start singing it was weird. And also, I quite like this from the behind-the-scenes stories, is that apparently Shooty and Merle, they knew that they had to do it. They knew what it sounded like. They'd heard it sort of being played on things for them to listen to several times and so on. And the day was getting closer and closer. And they're like, when's the studio day for when we're, because they assume they're going to, you know, lip sync it along to a recorded version they record and then go in and act along to it.
Yeah.
And they were going, well, when's that coming along? When's that, are we doing? And then suddenly the day of the shoot arrives. And then it was, well, no, you're doing it on set. You're doing this while you're doing this scene.
Mm-hmm.
What with all the ropes and the remembering to look in the direction of cardboard cutout goblins and in this green space that apparently at some point is going to look like a ship in the sky. What? Would it, what? Yeah, that's what happened. So yes, it's pitch corrected to buggery, which is a little unfortunate, but kind of forgiven when they really had to sing it on set at the same time as having to imagine everything around them. Fair play to them. It was a surprisingly good performance, especially from two performers who, yes, they're both stage school brats, but neither of them, I think, would put singing and music at the top of their resumes, from what I understand.
Yeah.
So fair play to them. Could I entirely, utterly, and forever live without another flipping musical number in main series Doctor Who?
Oh yeah.
Give them a pass because it's Christmas. Oh yes, please, Russell. I know you've got a thing about it at the moment. Stop it. Just leave that to Mouse spin-off shows and get on with it. the plot itself actually would have benefited without that distraction, because that was like a weird sort of weird break in what was otherwise a nice little time loop story, and you know, there were so many things going on there that were better than that. I sort of felt it cheapened it a bit. I quite like the fact that the new Doctor has gone back to something we haven't seen from the Doctor in a long while. He's gone back to one, having fun for fun's sake, which we haven't seen from a Doctor on screen anyway. It's been existed in books maybe, but not on screen for a very long time. The kind of cool, sexy Doctor in the nightclub dancing with that fella. That was we've not seen the Doctor dancing with fellas before, but we have seen the Doctor having fun just because it's a laugh before. So that was nice to see. But
I feel like we haven't seen anything like that since the Matt Smith days.
I think that's true.
We've seen that energy.
We've seen the cheeky, flirty Doctor. Back in Eccleston Zero was the last time I can really remember proper flirty Doctor. And that was very much part of Nine's character as well. It was part of that kind of juxtaposed sort of dark, sinister, broody thing alongside this sort of giddy buffoon thing that he did. Yes. Much like Tom Baker, much like Colin Baker, actually. They were probably highlights of that as well. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, we didn't need that. But the other thing is he's inventing things again. Now, we've not seen the Doctor inventing things, because I'm going to invent some things, for a long time. That was very much Tom Baker era, actually, I think. Well, actually, no, probably Pertwee, actually, more. And we've not really... I mean, we've seen the Doctor doing, you know, on-the-fly inventions a bunch of times since Who got rebooted, but it just made me think, oh, he's invented these, apparently with nothing particular in mind, but he's invented these gloves, which, incidentally, obviously every kid around the entire world went and got some crunched up tinfoil and put them down the fingers of their black winter gloves that they've got now, because that's how you make a super easy to play with toy. Mm-hmm. And I kind of hope from seeing that we're going to see a Doctor who has fun and invents stuff, because those are two facets of his character that we've not seen for a long time and kind of suit Shooty Gatwa down to the ground.
Oh,
so
yep.
Living for that. Before we get to the big moment at the end, have I missed anything?
I don't think so.
So we then come, don't we, to Mrs. Flood. by which I mean my grade 5 primary school teacher. That was her name. Now, the odd thing about that is because I'm used to thinking of... this is convoluted and weird. So she used to be called Miss Cole, that teacher. And then she got married and became Mrs. Flood. And my grandfather, who enjoyed words, used to refer to her as now being post-diluvian, which at the age of 7 or whatever it was, I was not entirely sure what that meant. I did look it up, though, and went, oh, after the flood.
Yes.
Oh, no, I get it. Okay. Now, therefore, whenever I see the word flood, for some reason, my brain immediately goes into the very literal like meaning of flood, water, something going from, you know, a lake to a flood, a river to a flood, a pond to a flood. Mm-hmm. Consequently, the second that I realized her name was Mrs. Flood, in my brain, immediately, I'm like, oh, it's river.
Yeah.
Or something directly to do with. Now, would it be a bloody weird choice to cast Anita Dobson as a role that Alex Kingston is already very good at playing and, as far as I am aware, very comfortable at returning to?
Yeah.
Unless she's massively loyal to Moffat in a way that extends beyond, you know, wanting to carry on doing a massively popular character, which I'm not sure she is. Especially seeing she's written her own bloody spin-off as well. It seems like a very odd decision at the moment to do that. So is this a recasting of now considerably aged River Song? I would say almost certainly not. Is this River Song's daughter? Or
I mean, they have
other relatives.
They've certainly not shied away from the wordplay with it. I mean, obviously you had River Song and you had Amy Pond. I feel like that's not entirely, I mean, and to be fair, whomever this person is, the way that this person responds or reacts at the very end of the episode is, you know, they went out of their way to be like, the episode's done. Oh, wait, hold on. We're going to focus on this person real quick. And then they're going to look right at the camera, like right at you.
So weird. Yeah.
And be like, you know, acting like he's never seen a TARDIS before. Yeah.
It's odd, isn't it? Because, I mean, so Russell's obviously staying tight-lipped about this. He's simply said, Mrs. Flood is a slow burn. Don't expect an answer anytime soon. But you will be getting references, you know, sort of sprinkled throughout. And by the way, I should say, because I think so many people are talking about whether this is, you know, either River or some relative of River, I think a lot of people are immediately starting to talk, as I did, about Alex Kingston, who is fucking iconic, obviously. But let's not overlook the fact that, and I realize this may be more for the British listeners than anywhere else in the world, but Anita Dobson is, she is an iconic television actress who, let's be honest, like the role for which she is abundantly known, in fact, almost exclusively known, unless you happen to be a big fan of the theatre, is as Angie Watts in EastEnders. And I think even outside of the UK, people are aware, maybe through YouTube perhaps these days, of the fact that, okay, so Dirty Den was her husband. He was the landlord. Well, they were landlord and landlady of the Queen Vic in EastEnders. And long before Peggy Mitchell, Barbara Windsor that being, shouting, get out my pub, and all that sort of stuff. Long before that, they were the original toxic married couple. They were violent to each other. It was bi-directional. They were abusive. Every second of their existence was drama coupled with intense but massively unhealthy, sort of over-the-top affection. It was a proper toxic, mutually abusive relationship that at times was incredibly difficult to watch. And this was... I talk about ahead of its time. I mean, when Anita Dobson was in EastEnders, I mean, she was in the show between 85 and 88, and it was 88 that finally saw her walk out the door. And there's a very famous scene where it's odd, actually, it's always the scene that's always shown when people talk about Anita. Whereas, in fact, the scene is almost entirely about Den, who was the husband. And that's on Christmas Day, a Christmas special, no less, of EastEnders in 1980, I think it was 87, maybe, when that happened, on the Christmas special in 1987, where with the words, happy Christmas, fucking idiot, happy Christmas, Ange, he hands her the divorce papers, which is just one of those, it was a big dramatic moment. People in the UK will know what I mean if I say it was the doof doof scene. And if you've not seen it, American listeners don't know what the fuck I'm talking about, promise you'll go and have a look at, go look for Den and Angie divorce Christmas or any of that, you'll find it. Go see that scene and you'll see who she is. Now, she's got that quality that a soap actor, particularly one in the 80s, kind of needed. You see so much intense, over the top, but like earnest drama in soap operas these days that, you know, must be pretty hard to stand out as a, you know, dramatic character in soaps now. And then you've got the other sort who are kind of like panto villain versions of bad guys in soaps, and there's probably too many of those as well. Anita Dobson's performance in EastEnders, I think the reason why the nation utterly fell in love with her, other than the fact that they were feeling horribly sorry for her because of her bastard husband, was the fact that Anita Dobson was so good at doing like high camp drama, but with a sort of weird level of authenticity that just didn't exist in you know, soap opera TV shows at the time. It's hard to describe. I realize I'm unanticipatedly fanboying over Anita Dobson.
what
I can tell you.
I'm sure she appreciates it, though.
This is the thing about her, though, is the fact that I bloody love her. I was having seen quite a lot of stuff of that, again, as you'll gather, behind the scenes stuff that that they've been, you know, putting out on this. And it is worth watching, by the way. The behind-the-scenes interview, very brief as it was, with Anita Dobson, who's obviously been told she's not allowed to say anything to anyone. She's incredibly endearing in the interviews. And, she's nothing like any of the characters she's ever played, as far as I can remember. She's very, very lovely. But she's obviously relishing whatever the big reveal is going to be, maybe even as far away as the end of this season, which, you know, we're talking about, middle of this year, nearly. Certainly late spring, maybe even early summer this year, before we find out the answer to that question. And she's got a gleeful look on her face every second when you see her on there. Compare and contrast to Davina McCall, who clearly was just fucking thrilled to have been on an episode of Doctor Who, and who could blame her, because if you work in television particularly, but if you work in any sort of entertainment medium, or even you're just a fan of it, the idea of being invited to, especially to be yourself in an episode of Doctor Who, that means
canonically you exist there.
Because this is it, because you are culturally significant enough to to be that. And it's interesting because
it's pretty cool.
We also know that Doctor Who and EastEnders technically exist in the same universe. Fans of the show will have to go back to a former Christmas special and locate the scenes in the Queen Vic, Angie's old pub, but not with Angie, in order to realise that everything in that is referred to as if EastEnders is real life. So there you go. Whereas we know Coronation Street isn't, because otherwise they'd recognise Millie Gibson.
Yeah.
As whatever her name is in that I can't remember.
Yeah, not Ruby. Not Ruby Sunday.
Not Ruby Sunday.
Maybe that's Ruby Tuesday. Call
her if I bump into her in town.
Ruby Tuesday.
There's a good chance there will. I mean, she's one of those faces you tend to see wandering about the city quite a bit. So
Ruby Tuesday, for those of you unaware, is an American chain restaurant.
It's also a song by, was that Carter? Carter USM, maybe? I can't remember.
It's what they named the restaurant after, was the song. Yeah.
I would Was it named after the song?
It was named after the song. Yeah, the restaurant was the restaurant chain.
After the Rolling Stones song, I presume.
Yes, yeah, the Rolling Stones song.
The other song, yeah.
So when I watched this, by the way, just get this out of the way real quick. I really liked the episode. The musical stuff was absolutely a detractor for me. The first bit, anyway, I was okay with. I'm like, all right, it's the Christmas special. Like, up into the, I don't, just being a musical doesn't necessarily make it a Christmas special, but it added more to it than anything else that made it feel like a Christmas special, which was they put a Santa hat on one of the goblins, and that was like they're like, here, Christmas special.
An inflatable Santa. Or,
that's no, true. Snowman.
Snowman.
Yeah, there was the inflatable snowman. We had like minor references to the holiday season. But I guess the musical portion made it feel a little more holiday. I don't know, the holiday vibes, I guess. Yeah, but just barely. Definitely Disney. It made it feel very Disney, I guess, in that regard. But I hope it's something that we don't see going forward. I guess the biggest umbrage that I take with it is where the Doctor and Ruby had to do their bit. Because it felt so weird. They're like, why do we got to be done singing? Keep playing music. And they're like, sure, why not? Let's keep playing music. And
the goblins don't... I mean, the goblins who we've established would already eat them, I think the Doctor says.
Yes.
I mean, they seem pretty chill. They're like, oh, as long as you don't stop the music, then that's fine. We won't eat you, even though you're stealing this baby.
Don't kill the party. Yeah, if you keep the party going.
Maybe it's just because they had a plan already, but yeah.
It felt very weird, even by Doctor Who standards.
I wasn't the biggest fan of this episode compared to the other three, I have to say.
Yeah. I will say this. I felt bad for Chris Chibnall and Jodie Whittaker and her run as the Doctor, because even though I didn't think this particular episode was the best, considering the Tennant episodes were great, but also... those episodes had an advantage of having people who had played those characters and perfected those characters and slipped right back into those characters. And, you know, it was written by the people, you know, it was written by the guy who, you know, helped mold those characters story-wise. So, you know, Shudigatwa did not have the advantage going into this episode that like David Tennant would have when it comes to just being comfortable and everything being everything being in place. And I would imagine that the team writing this new show is they're going to take a little bit of time to sort of find where everything fits in and like how to write for the character and stuff like that. Whereas with the Tennant episodes, you already know how to do that. Like, the blueprint's already there for how to write a David Tennant Doctor Who episode, and they did them quite masterfully. But I will say this. I felt bad watching this for Chibnall and Jodie Whittaker and that whole cast and crew, because by the time the credits rolled for me, for like the opening credit for the opening title card for this episode, because like I said in the last episode, they fit right in with the Tennant episodes. It fit like a glove. They went right back into it. To me, this was sort of the test. This is not David Tennant's Doctor. This is going to be something new. We can't rely on the nostalgia of characters we already know. You know, how is it going to feel? And right away, from the way it was filmed to the voiceover at the beginning and the mood and the setting and all of that stuff, I just had this immediate feeling of like, oh, Doctor Who is back, which felt like insulting to the last run of Doctor Who. But in a lot of ways, it's not like it didn't feel like Doctor Who, but there is always like a sort of feeling or a sort of tone. And it Chibnall's Who always felt like it was slightly off from that.
Oh, for sure.
Sometimes it felt way off from that, but most of the time it just felt slightly off, like it just wasn't quite there. And you know, Russell knows how to do this. Like he's also writing.
He's writing from the start with these particular actors, including Shuti Gatwa, in place. And one of the problems that we know was suffered, I think, by Chibnall and by Moffat, if I'm counting back, was there were chunks of those series, and therefore each of those Doctor's runs, that weren't written originally for the Doctor that they had.
Right.
And so they had to be retooled and everything else. And I do think that, I think that did have a very negative impact at times. We've spoken about it on the show a number of times. Whereas, you know, Russell's being invited back alongside Julie as well as, you know, kind of television gold, quite rightly. And they are having resources thrown at it. They were setting their terms for the base on which they were coming back. They've got a lot of clout at the BBC and probably no small amount of clout at Mouse now. And so, you know, I think it might be easier to put that, you know, that whole package, that whole feel of, right, we're pressing the reset button to some extent. Here is now Who, and we're going to drag back, for example, the old logo, old logo, in fact, pretty much, and just give it a slight tweak so it feels more familiar again. We're going to make it more comfortable to watch because at times, particularly Chibnall, went in a kind of difficult to watch aesthetic that sometimes I think, well, certainly wouldn't have fitted the way that Russell writes. I think there was a lot of opportunity to give the whole thing just a bit of a shake here. You're coming off the familiarity high of David and Catherine, and nobody died, so you know that they're all fine. Don't worry about them. No one's on that downer of, oh, I can't believe they got rid of that. Oh, who's this one then? You know, they were an interesting palate cleanser, some would unfairly say, perhaps since between 13 and 15. Maybe it is easier, but this is where it gets difficult. The team now heading this at Bad Wolf have got to be as good as the trust put in them. And I mean, the Russell trust index, to borrow from our own podcast's previous lore, is pretty high. But at the same time, you know, these things don't last forever. So I will be fascinated to see whether they are able to make good on the promise, basically, that they've made to the BBC and to Disney. And those are two very different paymasters, I would suggest. The audiences for which they're producing material are, yes, a lot of commonality, but also a lot of difference. How often will you get away with, you know, aging soap star Anita Dobson and reality TV presenter Davina McCall as your, you know, headline cameo turns in this TV show when you're making it for an American audience? I would venture to suggest not very often. Mm-hmm. But how far does that take you away from that feel that of shows that Russell makes? Quite dramatically, I would say. Mm. So, I don't know. I think there is a lot of freshness about this, and I do feel a little bit sorry for Moffat and Chibnall, but I also think that, you know, there is a rod fashioned for someone's back here, and I'm pretty sure they're up for it and up to it, but I think he must be the happiest man in television and also possibly the most nervous man in television now.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot riding here, I think.
Big time, yeah.
I mean, whether the show is good or not won't even be an indicator of if it's going to catch on and be popular or lucrative.
Expect lots of merch appearing connected to the universe soon. I mean, that new Sonic screwdriver, if you ask me, people are going, why have they made it that shape? Why is it? I'm going to put a little bit of money here and say that maybe summer or maybe for Christmas of next year, they've already designed the toy and that's the shape the toy is. It is probably an electronic toy of some description that ties into other electronic toys that are going to be released at some stage. I think what you're seeing there is a little gadget that's a teaser, not of this Doctor. It's a teaser of merch to come.
Yeah. I got to say, not a fan of the design of that, by the way.
No, nobody I've heard talk about it is a fan at all. Whereas everyone liked 14s.
Yeah.
Which we barely saw. Oh, 14 screwdriver, we barely knew thee.
Yeah, barely. But I mean, here, it's one of the few aesthetic choices that I didn't care for. But everything else, though, I thought looked great.
And also, by the way, why does it not work with rope? Because he's definitely used it with rope in the past.
For sure.
Is it because it's special goblin rope?
Oh, hard to... That must be it, Ben.
Yeah.
It doesn't work with rope that you can read. He had to learn rope, famously, so...
Although I have taken up a new post of Gin and Tonic Inspector.
That's smart. Very smart. We need those. We need
was
more that
what it,
than
was
that.
That what it, I can't remember if that was the name of the role. I think it was. Gin and Tonic Safety Inspector or something?
Oh, yeah, it was something like that. Gin and Tonic Division or something.
Yeah, well, that makes sense. I think that should be a thing.
You're up for it. Okay, so what would you give the episode zero? The Christmas special. What would you give it on the Geeky Glasses scale, Ben?
Well, that's it, isn't it? No one can determine what bloody episode number this is.
No.
I think officially it's been... Is it shipped as 304?
Production episode 304, yeah.
Yeah, but I think... Isn't it supposed to be series... season one... I don't bloody know. Anyway,
I'm counting it as yeah. I'm definitely counting it as season 14 or series 14. But episode
I think
zero.
It is. Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to be a cantankerous git who insists we use the old numbering system because even I've lost track of what fucking number that would be. But yeah. So just for this episode, interestingly, not as good as the previous three, but a promising start. And for those reasons, I'm going to give it a 3.5 because the things that were good were good. The things that I didn't like weren't so bad that they ruined this episode for me.
Yeah, that's where I landed. I went with 3.5 as well, with the same mindset. Like a good start. The stuff that worked really worked. The stuff that didn't quite work. But I'm not, some of that I'm owing up to just shrugging it off as like, that's the Christmas special talking, you know, we'll see what we're in for when everything starts going full steam in the spring. That's right, everybody. The podcast is over and we won't see you again for several months.
Good job we talked so long.
Welcome to Doctor Who. Yeah. Well, by the time we're done talking, you're like, oh man, thank God. I'm going to need to wait until the spring just to be ready to listen to them talk again about Doctor Who.
Let's get an email in from listeners saying, can we just have Glenn talking about it? What do you think of this then, Glenn? It's all right.
Classic Glenn. Okay, so that's the podcast for now, everybody. I'm always tempted to say for this week. It's going to be a bit before we're on a weekly Doctor Who schedule. But for now, that is the episode. Head on over to cinemageekly.com where you can check out the archives of the show. And of course, this is a listener-supported podcast, and you can help out a couple of ways there if you'd like. We have a Patreon, patreon.com/cinemageekly. We also have a merchandising store, Ben.
Merchandising, where the real money from the podcast is made.
Geeklymerch.com.
That's right, featuring our one piece of Doctor Who merch, the Double Moffat merchandise, which
I keep wearing and keep being complimented on.
Do you? Okay, so I've had to explain it to more people than I've seen buy it, but
had that too.
I'm like, well, you see, Stephen Moffat was a showrunner on Doctor Who. He had a certain thing that he'd like to do, and sometimes he would flip it around on you, and we'd call that a double. Anyway, you should buy the shirt.
It made sense at the time.
It's such a weird piece of merch to have on the store. Maybe we'll think of more Doctor Who related merch going forward.
And the mouse will come after us.
Oh, you got to be careful. Yeah, I don't want Bob Iger knocking on my door.
No one does.
Nobody does. The links for those things in the show notes for this episode. And of course, you can find us on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and Audible. Just search for Who Made Who, hit subscribe, and that way you can join us next time, sometime in the spring, where we will talk about episode 1 of series 14 of Doctor Who.
Doctor Who in space and time.